started, and as people, I think we have a few more coming. But I want to welcome everyone that is here for our second Zoom meeting. We had a really good turnout last time and a lot of participation. We have an excellent set of presentations that we'll get to here together today, and hopefully have some good discussion based on the information we get to hear about. So again, welcome everyone. I'm going to do Marita's going to help me with roll call today because I'm able to get the list of everybody's names. I've asked her to do is to go ahead and just call off everybody's name, and if you would please reply by saying that you're either on the phone or you're on Zoom. And then after we finish with that, I'll see if we have any guests present as well. Thank you, Dorothy.
Oh, my pleasure. Oh, we will start with Sandy Brown.
I'm here.
Welcome. Joan Cayley. Joan is here, but she stepped away. Let's see, Paul. Paul is here.
I'm Paul.
Okay. Mark.
Here.
Remy. RJ.
Here.
All right. Adrian let us know she wasn't going to be present. Dave Fuller.
I'm here.
And Charbonneau.
I am here.
Katie.
Here.
Dr. Neville.
I'm here, thank you.
Oh, awesome. John Brooks.
I'm here.
All right.
On the phone.
Awesome. Stephanie. She said she most likely wouldn't be able to make it along with John Roth. Marla Wayne Sanger is here.
Right here.
Cassandra?
Here, thank you.
And Aru?
I'm here.
All right.
Thank you. Usually we'll have people say what their role is on FAC, but because we have such a big agenda today, I think we'll just keep moving on. Are there any guests present? And if you are, would you please state your name? And I also would ask if you had any desire to speak at this evening's meeting. So if there are any guests, state your name and let us know if you'd like to speak.
Marla, this is Joan. I'm back.
Okay, thanks, Joan. Okay, I'm not hearing any identify themselves, so I think we can move on. The first thing we'll do is to go ahead and ask for approval of the minutes from the June 9th meeting. So has everyone hopefully had a chance to look at those? And thank you, Doreen, for doing such a great job of providing us with very, very good capture of what happened in our meetings. Could someone please offer up a motion that we accept
motion
the minutes?
To approve.
Thank you, Remy.
Second.
Was that Paul?
Second.
Thank you, Paul. We have a motion and we have a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. Move right on to the presentations. Unless I have forgotten something, anybody? Please feel free to correct me. I'm a little bit befuddled by my total computer fail today. So the first thing that we get to hear about tonight is the environmental public health update. And so we will invite the team to identify themselves and provide us with an update. Thank you.
I think there are two presentations slotted for tonight. I'm with the Rec Water Program. Bridget, do you mind if I start?
No, please go ahead.
No. Okay.
I want.
Or my screen.
Open the pie pool.
Okay. Did Lizzie clean it up?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, go back with Evie.
Okay. Can you guys see this okay?
Yep, very good.
Yes.
So my name is Brian Schlamm, and I'm a program manager with the Rec Water Program with EPH. And I'm going to talk about the Swim Beach Monitoring Program tonight. I am not going to go into a lot of detail about how and when we take samples. I'm going to touch some current events that are happening right now. But if you guys have questions about our program, I'm happy to answer those at the end, or I can do a follow-up email if you'd like. So let's start with Vancouver Lake. I think if you haven't seen, Vancouver Lake is on a danger advisory, which is a lake closure, and that's due to elevated cyanotoxins that we found in the water. This picture right here is from July 27th. What we see is 1.4 micrograms per liter, which is not above the threshold, but you can see there's scum on shore and on the water. The entire lake actually is green. Even to this day, it's still green. I'll go into the reasons why we think that is. But an important piece of our program is we rely on the public to let us know when there's water quality issues when it comes to algae. Friends of Vancouver Lake at Vancouver Lake has been fantastic so far. And they're on the lake every day. So if we see a bloom, we don't have paddle boards or kayaks, so we're not out actually in the lake. And so we call out our friends at Friends of Vancouver Lake, and they help us understand the extent of the bloom. And so they were really very helpful in letting us know that the bloom that's happening right now, we believe, is covering about 90% of the lake, if not the entire lake. So looking at the last few years, the dark teal you can see is 2018. The red line that goes across there, that's a 2019 threshold. Up until just this year, the EPA and Washington Department of Health, the threshold for microcystin was 6 micrograms per liter. This year they upped it to 8 micrograms per liter. So anything above that would have issued either a warning or a danger advisory. Anything below that, if there's algae present, then we would have just a caution advisory, advising people to avoid areas of scum altogether. 2020 compared to last year, you can see is much improved. Last year was, I think, the worst year we've had for Vancouver Lake on record. This year, you can see we had a bloom a little bit early in the year, and then that went away, and now this bloom that we're currently seeing, covering most of the lake, is here. The last sample we drew last Monday came back at 9 micrograms, so just over the limit, but because the algae bloom is covering the majority of the lake, we moved towards danger. That's considered an extensive bloom. And one of the challenges we have is we draw samples on Monday. We don't get results back until Thursday. So that's just telling us that at the point that we drew the sample, it was toxic. And I'll show you some images on the next slide that both here and at Lacamas Lake, they tell you you really can't judge a bloom by looking at it. You can't judge the toxicity. At Vancouver Lake, something that interesting that happened, I want to make the statement that correlation is not causation here, but we happen to have the milfoil treatment on July 7th. And following the milfoil treatment, there was a massive die-off of the milfoil and a huge addition of nutrients to the water. With that, 90-degree weather, any kind of turbulence on the bottom, fluffing up nutrients, we're now seeing the worst bloom that we've ever had on record on this lake, and it looks like somebody dumped paint on top of the water, which is typical for bad blooms, blue-green algae blooms. Following the treatment, we visited the lake every week, and then we saw the bloom start on the 20th. And some of the other variables that are coming into play is you've got stormwater inflow from just neighboring streets. You have Lake River, which is flowing through some agricultural land, also receiving stormwater. A lot of sun hitting the water. We say that there's 3 ingredients for algae. There's sunlight, there's warm water, and there's nutrients, each of which we knew were abundant during this time. So the top picture you see milfoil growing. The bottom picture is what it looks like when it dies off. These are pictures of Vancouver Lake. And our internal process is we draw some samples, and the genus, the dominant genuses that we're seeing is Dilophosphermum and Microcystis. Of those, we're measuring for two toxins, anatoxin, which is a neurotoxin, and microcystin, which is a liver toxin. And you can see some pictures here. The first picture from July 27th, 1.4 micrograms. The next picture from the 3rd, August 3rd, is at 9 micrograms. And again, that's just over the limit. But here you can really see the what looks like paint on the surface. If you guys see this ever, we would appreciate a call. Chances are, hopefully, we know about it already, but don't go in. Pets, children are the greatest risk because of the hand-to-mouth. Dogs don't really know any different. They'll drink this water, and if it's toxic, it can have some really bad effects on our pets. Then we have Lacamas Lake, another popular swimming area. This is just next to the boat launch. This picture is from 720. Here, this is the most current, the red line right here is the most current threshold at 8 micrograms. And you can see the difference in scale. So the toxicity we're seeing at Lacamas Lake is significantly higher. There is a spike on Vancouver Lakes that you couldn't see. It was just outside view. That was 35 micrograms, and that was the highest that we had seen last year, and actually in years past. And here you can see Lacamas Lake, we've got 45, 34, all the way up to 76 micrograms. That's a lot. There are, not to diminish this number, but there are lakes in Washington that are seeing 5,000 micrograms per liter, so it does get much worse with different blooms. Looking at 2019, there's a small green line there because we only had a bloom for 2 weeks last year, and the toxicity was, both samples were below the threshold. 2018, you don't see anything here because it was in October when we saw it in 2018. The micrograms were 26, so it was elevated in October. We issued our advisories, and it was only there for 2 weeks, and then it was gone. Again, the genuses of that are dominating this lake, we're seeing much more variety in Lacamas Lake. The same things apply for why a bloom is happening. We don't quite understand the stormwater that's coming in there. There's also different industry right on the lake, automotive shop, golf course. The inflow of water is flowing through agriculture land, so that's having a big impact, as well as the sun and warm water. And that is all I have for that. Another update, and again, I covered a lot of information and is very just the surface of what we do. I was hoping to also update you guys on what's happening with our rec water pool permits real quick. Because of COVID, pools cannot open. There's a modified phase one where general use pools could open following specific guidance. But to date, our what we call limited use pools are still not able to open. That'll be in phase three. And those are HOAs, apartment pools, hotel pools, anything that doesn't allow the general public to come in. So to respond to that, we have inactive pool permits just so that they meet the Department of Health guideline for water quality, making sure they're not becoming vectors. Harboring vectors, mosquitoes. The process for that is they apply for a reduced permit, and that is to allow staff to come out and just spot check, make sure in fact they are closed. And we're seeing more and more. The longer this gets extended, the more facilities we're seeing requesting these inactive permits. So short and sweet. Is there any questions that I can answer for anyone?
This is Paul. What part of the year does it appear, and what part of the year does it disappear?
The reason I'm having a hard time answering that is because last year we never really saw it end. Typically, I've been with the county for about a year and a half now. When I came on, I looked at past records, and it was isolated for the most part to the swim season, Memorial Day to Labor Day. Last year, we were seeing blooms November, December, February. The interesting thing about the blooms we saw is it's an algae called a Anaxagora, which is a cooler water algae, so it is in 50 to 60 degree waters, but it is a toxic producing algae. and that was at Fallen Leaf Lake that we saw those. So interesting that we, our season is not what we're used to seeing.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Brian? Okay, Brian, thank you so much. We'll turn it over now to Bridget, who's going to provide us with the COVID-19 restaurant outreach.
I think Katie might have a question.
Okay.
I don't have a question. I'm sorry, I saw your hand up. Sorry about that. Hey, Bridget, I think you're on mute.
Yeah, we can see the slide.
Maybe it is you doing that.
We have microphone problems because I can hear her faintly, but I can hear something.
Can you hear me okay? I can go get earbuds real quick. And
now you're good.
Okay.
You're good now.
Okay, great. So my name's Bridget Bashaw. I am the Food Safety Program Manager. I've been with the Food Safety team since the end of 2018. And what I am here to share with you today are the different approaches that the Food Safety team are using to provide COVID-19 related information with food workers and food establishment owners. I'm trying to figure out how to forward my slides. There we go. So we've used a handful of different ways to reach out to owners and food workers, including newsletters, the Clark County Public Health COVID-19 website, canvassing, routine inspections, and complaint follow-up. Most of what I'll be talking about today is on our canvassing effort because that is specific to COVID-19, while throughout all other normal times, we use the other methods to share information with operators and food workers. So newsletters were relied upon heavily in the early stages of the outbreak as information was changing quickly. We send these newsletters to food workers and owners that we attain email addresses for during the plan review stages and during our routine inspections. Part of our routine inspection, the way that we deliver the inspection report to the owner and the food workers is through email, so we are able to get a lot of current emails from people. Our list contains about 1,600 email addresses, and we've seen about a 40 to 50% open rate, like email open rate, during the COVID-19 response. So the newsletter was a pretty effective way to reach out to people. One of the features on the newsletter, which is kind of nice, it's still active, is the submit a question button. And this allowed the food establishments to ask us a specific question about their business as they were reading resources and trying to figure out how the requirements affected their operations. The newsletters are static in the information that they provide, so we do what we can in these to direct readers to our local public health website to stay current with the information. This is a snippet of the Clark County Public Health COVID-19 website. That website contains a lot of information, a lot of good information on the public health response and the governor's Safe Start plan. It has information specific to businesses and different groups and organizations. But in addition to information that's available there for employers and businesses, we have a section specific to food establishments. What we're trying to provide owners and workers is information that we have found they definitely need to know for the safe continuation of their operation. We're pulling together information here that's assembled from the Department of Health, Labor and Industries, the Liquor Control Board, the Governor's Office, the Governor's Office. A lot of different agencies are putting together information that food establishments need to know. And so we're trying to give them kind of a one-stop shopping with links to all of those agencies, of course. We do review the links regularly to make sure that they're working, and we do have the ability to update information to keep it current very quickly. Let's see. So canvassing, we started doing canvassing in mid-April. We hired temporary employees to share COVID-19 specific collected information directly with food establishments. So far, the canvassers have visited over 500 food establishments, and those visits last about 20 minutes. The canvasser provides a packet of information that contains all the documents that are shown here on the slide. And then the documents and the conversation describe the governor's orders, and it provides guidance and checklists for the physical facilities themselves and for continuing operations. Some of the documents include the dining log and face covering signages, social distancing signs for the businesses to put up if they haven't done so already, or to give them additional signs to put up. The canvassers also assess how the food establishment is implementing public health measures that should be in place to reduce the spread of COVID-19 between both employees and at that employee-customer interface. Our visits last between 10 to 60 minutes, and some of the factors that determine the length of our stay include the size of the facility, the level of compliance that is already in place when we visit the facility, and then how many questions the operator has and how much conversation they want to have with us while we're there. The assessment has changed between phase one and phase two. When food service was limited just to takeout and delivery, we were looking at the social distancing that was in place between customers and at that customer-employee interface. We were checking to verify the sanitizer, that the sanitizer was at proper concentrations, and that there was warm water available in the sinks for adequate hand washing. Phase two, the assessment for phase two was expanded as dine-in service was allowed in establishments. Now we're looking, in addition to the things that we're looking at in phase one, we're now looking to see that tables are set up to be 6 feet apart, and the occupancy is limited to 50%. We are checking to verify that single-use menus and single-use condiments and utensils are used. We're talking with people about the requirements of the contact list. We're looking to see that there's sanitizer available for customers and that masks are used by staff and customers. And these two tables show, so the top table shows a comparison between the criteria that has been in place both during phase one and phase two. And the bottom table shows just those items that have been in place during phase two. What we're seeing is that social distancing is improving over time. And that some of the challenges that remain are maintaining social distance between tables, that 6 foot separation between tables, in addition to insisting staff require wear masks and that customers actually have face coverings when they come in. Our food safety specialists continue to conduct routine inspections, and we continue to respond to complaints that are submitted by the public. Complaints include those relating to foodborne illness, but also about COVID-19 public health measures. So we respond to all of those. Those responses, those visits, the routine inspection visits, and our complaint responses include that same packet of information that we share during our canvassing efforts. So every opportunity we have to speak with a food worker or an owner, we're sharing COVID-19 information. So far, at first, our canvassing effort was received with a little bit of resistance, but over time, what our canvassers are reporting now is that food establishments and those workers are very willing to talk with us when we come in to the establishment. They want to show us what they are doing, and they have questions. They've been trying to implement the different public health measures for long enough now that they really do have questions, and they want to hear if there's a way that they can improve. So it's being well received, which is nice feedback, because food inspectors don't always get that kind of feedback, just because people don't want to be inspected. I believe that is what I have for how we're sharing COVID-19 information with food establishment operators and workers. So I'm available for questions too, if there are some.
Bridget, this is Paul. Have you had resistance in the bars in particular as opposed to just the restaurants?
I don't think that we've had resistance so much, but I think compliance within the bars during their actual...
That's what I should have said.
Yeah.
Problems with compliance. Because it was my understanding that the bars were having problem with social distancing in particular, and in some cases masks, but mainly the social distancing.
Yes, I think that we receive more complaints about kind of bars, taverns, businesses that primarily focus on their alcohol service. We have more complaints about those facilities than some of the other facilities. In response to that, in the last month or so, we have put forth an effort to make to focus on those types of establishments to make sure that we are sharing information with them, that they at least are in the know of what the requirements are.
Mommy, I want the present.
Bridget, I have a question.
Well, thank you very much.
My quick question is, we kind of puzzle over how this works in a restaurant that has a buffet, where people are handling the same serving tables, one person after another, another, another. Does that require any special education for the employees or the guests?
Maybe not. A little bit. At first, buffet service was not allowed during phase one. During phase one it was, and then during phase two it was restricted, and then it was again allowed. Part of our requirements for buffet service is to have the stations manned by employees, and the employees, I believe, are actually doing the service now versus the guests just coming through and picking what they want. So those utensils are handled by employees instead of guests. Public health measures. They still need to social distance, and so a buffet requires a lot more oversight by the employees than it did previously. So definitely education. There's a heavy component of education in all of the food establishments, but it really does take a lot of active managerial control, we call it, and that can be better in some establishments than others.
Thank you.
I would think that they could have someone to oversee the social distancing, particularly in that in a buffet type situation.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion.
Yeah, the requirement for a social distancing officer, there is a requirement for a social distancing officer for all food establishments. It doesn't have to be a dedicated person, but somebody is supposed to be assuming the role of overseeing social distancing. And in a buffet situation, especially a large buffet, some buffets are bigger than others. I could see that being
right.
A job.
Any other questions for Bridget? Hearing none, we'll move on to the next item. And in case you don't have an agenda in front of you, the next area we're going to talk about is the department and COVID-19 updates. So we'll begin by having Jeff Harbison provide us with some information about the budget, the EPH fees, and the CARES Act funding.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
I'm going to start at the bottom of that list, our environmental public health fee schedule. We have two ordinances going before the Board of Health scheduled for August 26th, 2 weeks from tomorrow. We presented the Board of Health with three options in one-on-ones and one-on-twos. They could not come to consensus on one option, but we definitely narrowed it down to two options. The guidance we received was bring both of those options forward as separate ordinances for Board of Health on the 26th. They will then deliberate amongst themselves in that public setting and pick which option they prefer to move forward with. The first option maintained our cost recovery models from the 2020 fee schedule, so it doesn't change any cost recovery. And option number two just moved the two programs that are not yet at full cost recovery slightly closer to cost recovery. The COVID, the CARES Act funding, public health was lucky. We initially received $1.05 million directly to us to kick off the COVID response work. The feds then released the coronavirus relief fund. $26.8 million went to Clark County. Jurisdictions with populations greater than 500,000 were able to contract directly with the feds. Clark County at the time was at 488,500. We were just below that threshold. Had we been above 500,000, our share would have been right around 90 million, 88 to 90 million. We received 26.8 million. The guidance from the feds when the money went, so the jurisdiction smaller than 500,000, all that funding went to the state, and the guidance provided to the state was they preferred states use the same process to calculate what each jurisdiction would actually be receiving. Unfortunately, state of Washington did not release about $60 million to Clark County that was due us using the feds model. We received 26.8. We're a little lucky as well in that Clark County definitely is putting the money where the response is. There are some counties that the public health departments are receiving nothing of this CARES Act funding. Clark County Public Health, we're receiving just under $11 million, or that's been obligated to us. The other piece, along with the reduced funding, is the federal funding went to the state with an allocation period ending December 31st. Not only did the state short us about $60 million, they also cut us off as of October 31st. So we have 2 months with no funding. We're hearing that funding may be opened up soon to cover the last 2 months of the year, but that's nothing is solid yet. Nothing is actually formal yet at this point. A lot of the funding, around $5 million, is slated to go to Public Health Institute, who has contracted with us to do contact monitoring for cases. Once there's a contact identified, PHI, Public Health Institute, does that contact monitoring daily. We have contracted staff and our own employees, in some cases, doing the case investigation, wraparound services, which is basically paying people's rent or mortgage, providing groceries, prescription drugs for people that are in isolation and quarantine and are not able to go out or work. If there are any questions, I should have asked for questions after the fee discussion. If there's any questions around environmental public health fees, I'm guessing there might not be, but there might be questions around the CARES Act funding. If anybody has questions about what I talked about with the CARES Act, COVID funding, no. All right. Our 2021 budget was due last Monday, the 5th. Is that the 5th? Anyway, it was due sometime last week. We're using a new budget system in Clark County. We went with a new system called Questica. This is our first year using it. It is a fantastic budget system. I told everyone I can possibly talk to about it, how good it is. It saved me a lot of time. Our budget process is difficult because we're pretty thin in finance. However, we did submit the budget. It was a very difficult budget process. We'll be able to share some specifics, I'm sure, at the next FAC meeting. The county did require every department receiving general fund support to submit packages reducing their general fund support by 8%. We did follow through with that exercise. And the only other thing I want to talk about the 8% is we also have the medical examiner's office under our purview now. There wasn't a package I could come up with to reduce the medical examiner's budget by 8%. I notified the budget director. She asked me to send her that in writing. I did so, and that's been several weeks, and we did not get any pushback. So I believe the medical examiner's office will not be subject to the 8% general fund reduction. Last but not least, we have the 2020 budget. The COVID supplemental, so all of our, none of the COVID funding, none of the $11 million or the PHI contracts, none of that was in our 2020 budget. So we have to go through a supplemental process to allocate that. That was due yesterday. And then next Monday, our mid-year supplemental for the rest of our budget is also due. So we got a lot of budget work going on across a pretty short period of time. But luckily, I've been here a long time, so I can handle it. If there's any questions on budget or anything I talked about at all, if Alan wants to say anything about anything in the CARES or anything else, feel free. Alan,
I think you hit the CARES funding pretty well. So the state, I think you articulated the state is sitting on 240 additional million dollars they've been sitting on, and I think we'll hear Friday, and that has to be spent by the end of December as well. And I think, if I remember correctly, because some of the counties did not allocate any of it to public health, I think 40 of that 240 has to go to public health, and they'll be, we heard from the Secretary of Health this morning on a call that apparently that I think he's meeting with I think they're putting that budget together, or whatever it's called, but I'm hoping to hear maybe by the end of the week about that additional funding. So we'll keep folks posted. But that would mean a significant additional chunk of change for us, but we're likely to need it with all the staff that we have to bring online around case investigation and contact notification and monitoring.
I think
so far we've brought on like around 70, Jeff, how many, including the contract with PHI, how many folks do we have working on this now?
It's got to be more than 70 at this point. Yeah. It's got to be closer to 80. The one thing I wanted to add about the COVID funding is, since the Coronavirus Relief Fund, the CARES Act funding, the large pot of money that went to Clark County expires December 31st, we received very late in the game another influx of $467,000 directly to public health that will expire in 2021. We are sitting on that. We are exhausting the Coronavirus Relief Fund dollars that expire this year, and we're sitting on that $467,000 for 2021. It won't go far in 2021, but we want to make sure that we stockpile as much as we can for January and February.
I just want to give a little highlight in comparison when Jeff was talking about the direct funding. Spokane, which has about 20 or 30,000 more people than Clark County, because they're over 500,000, they actually got $90 million directly from the feds, where we got our paltry, well, it doesn't sound paltry, but comparatively got $26.8 million. That being said, I think the Spokane Health District, Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, they only got $6 million from their county,
yes.
whereas we're able to get close to $11 million of the $26.8 here. So I'm actually feeling pretty good about what we were able to put together so far.
Yeah, despite Clark County getting shorted a little over $60 million, we're blessed to have been given the funding that we have been given by our county council and Board of Health.
Any other questions or any questions for Jeff? Not. And we'll move on to Dr. Melnick's director's report. And if you don't have an agenda in front of you, you can talk about COVID-19, the phase 3 update related to that, and racism as a public health crisis.
Am I going to talk about racism after Aru or beforehand or whatever you guys want me to do?
I think the idea, Alan, was that you were going to give a quick update of the discussions that have been had in the county, and then that would lead into Aru's presentation.
Yeah. And then I'll follow after Aru. Is that it, Roxanne?
I think the idea would be you would precede Aru.
Okay.
If you feel like you have some other things to add after her presentation, we can certainly do that.
Well, I have some slides on racism as a public health crisis, because it's some of the slides I presented to the Board of Health as well. So I'll go ahead and include those. the first thing I'm going to do is do a quick COVID-19 update. I'm sure we can't all get enough of COVID-19. This is basically the state numbers, close to 64,000 cases, over 6,000 hospitalizations, and close to 1,700 deaths. You might notice that the state had been presenting the percent positive, the percent of tests that were positive, but they've had a glitch with their with the data system, so we'll have to wait a while before they post that. But we've been posting our local numbers here in Clark County. The good news is that the reproductive number, so the reproductive number is for every person who's contagious with COVID-19, the number of new cases that they infect or cause. And if the number is above one, that means each case infects more than one other person, you get an exponential rise in cases. It's kind of like compound interest with money. So you want the reproductive number to be under one. The good news is about several weeks ago, it was about 1.6, I believe, if I remember correctly, and it's now down to 1.12, and it's gone down even, since last week when it had already been down to 1.19, or the last time the reporting was done in Western Washington. In Eastern Washington, it looks like it's below one, so that's kind of good news. The bad news is we've plateaued at a fairly high case rate. We'll talk about it in a minute, and it's not going up so much, but it's kind of flat, but it's still pretty high. Any of the flattening that we're seeing is appears to be due to changes in behavior. So hopefully we believe more people are using face coverings and keeping physical distance. The measures, the mobility measures, like the amount of traffic and all that, it doesn't correlate to the, so that, it uses cell phone location to look at mobility. And the change, what we're seeing in terms of the flattening of rate, doesn't correlate to the mobility data. So it looks like it's really related to changes in behavior more so than people being out and about. The concern we've had, and I don't believe I have that slide this time, is that when we first saw the increased cases late June and early July, they were, and not just in Washington, but elsewhere, they were seen in a predominantly younger age group, 0 to 39, and the concern we had at that time is that we were a few weeks behind Florida, which experienced the same thing. You can't keep the cases, you can't keep cases confined. You can't keep the virus confined. And, those younger people, when they got infected, over time they interact with older people who have a higher degree of morbidity, mortality. We're beginning to see that here. So the cases now are flat or decreasing in the younger age groups, but they're beginning to increase in the 40 to 69 and 70 and older age groups. We're going to look at that, watch that closely. Right now, here's a reproductive number. So we're a little bit above one in Western Washington, below one in Eastern Washington now. Here's the data about the incidence by age, and you can see that the 0-39 folks are plateauing or maybe decreasing slightly, but we're beginning to see increases in the older populations. I'll talk about hospital numbers in a minute here. These are the number of cases that we've had. Oh, here's the hospital data. So we've had, over the weekend, actually, we had Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we had 92 cases, which is average, which is about a little bit over 30 a day. To be at that reopening metric of 25 per 100,000 population over 14 days, we really have to have fewer than 9 cases a day, and we've been averaging well above that. 30 cases a day over the weekend, 11 yesterday. The good news, if there's some good news about this, is that we're not yet seeing hospital capacity being compromised like, you know, we saw in Florida. We're going to be watching this closely, given what's happening with the incidence by age. But right now, you want to have the metric for concern is about is when 10% of licensed beds are occupied by people with COVID-19, and we're well below that. And we, as you can see, we're under 2/3 of hospital licensed beds occupied in general, and that means we have a lot of hospital capacity. We'll be watching that closely. This is the epi curve of the bars are the number of cases per day. The line is the cumulative cases. The steeper the line, the greater the increase in number of cases. You can see back in April, you know, late March, April, we had that first surge. Then I think the middle blip is when we had that large Firestone Foods outbreak. And then you can see things flattened in early June, and we were doing really well, and then things started getting out of hand again late June into July and into August. These are this is kind of a busy slide. The only point I want to make about this is that a couple of points about this, and one is that several points. One is, if you look at positivity there, kind of like the third column in, we really, one of the measures of COVID-19 activity in the community is the percent positive. And you really want that to be, the percent of tests that are positive, you want that to be below 2%. We actually, COVID-19 isn't the only disease that we use a percent of positive as a measure. During the flu season, we actually declare flu season when 10% of samples, specimens for flu are positive. That's how we know we're in flu season. Similarly, with COVID-19, although the numbers are different, we know where we've got COVID activity, more COVID activity when the percent positive is greater than 2%. And, you know, in some states in the South, you're having double-digit positivity numbers. And back earlier this year, when cases were high in the Puget Sound area, they were in the 13 to 15% range. We got as high as, I think at one point we were up to, you can see that on July 11th, we were at 4.4. We're now down to a little bit over 3%. That's good news. The other point I want to make, a couple of points I want to make about this is that you might have heard, you know, and there's been misinformation on social media and elsewhere that the reason we were seeing more cases in late June and early July was because of the more testing that was done. And you can see June 20th and July, the number of the increase in positivity, in case positivity, was much greater than the increase in the number of cases that we were seeing. So we were seeing more cases because we had more cases, not because we do more testing. The last thing at the top there is we want to be below 25 per 100,000. We're right now, we're at 88, and that is considered, below 25 is considered low activity, 25 to 75 is moderate activity, and greater than 75 is high level of activity. So we're still in the high activity range. You might recall that we submitted a phase 3 application on June 26th, and that was just before the large number of cases came in. So we never got to phase 3, and actually Governor Inslee extended the pause on all phase applications, you know, reopening indefinitely, and ours has returned. And we're continuing to monitor those metrics, but we're nowhere close to being able to move into, even if we were able to, we weren't anywhere close to be able to apply for, to move into the next phase. On July 23rd, considering what was going on, Governor Inslee, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Health, announced changes to the phase covering order, beginning, and some of the changes that were made, were that, And I'm going to just highlight a couple of them. You know, knowing the relationship between alcohol use and transmission, people, their behaviors are disinhibited. And you might, we had a perfect example of that here in Clark County with our outbreak at the Orchards tap room. Alcohol service must end by 10 p.m. The vending game areas are closed. The bars, in phase three, we never made it to phase three, but phase three allowed bars to be open with some restrictions on the occupancy, but they were closed down by the governor's order, and no matter what phase you're in. And then in phase three, I believe table size was allowed to be 10, but now it was reduced to 5 people. And occupancy in the old phase three, restaurant occupancy was 75%, but it was reduced to 50% capacity for those in phase three. The gyms, the fitness centers are now more restricted than they were. And the weddings and funerals, beginning August 10th, it doesn't matter what phase you're in, you're only allowed to have ceremonies and not receptions, and both indoor and outdoor are limited to 30 people. And then, you know, bowling alleys are still closed, arcades, mini golf, those indoor family entertainment centers are closed, card rooms. Movie theaters, I believe, in phase three were originally at 50%, they're now at 25%. And then on July 25th, the face covering order went into effect. That extends to any indoor setting outside your home. And that includes private settings as well. And then the outdoor setting where you can't maintain 6 feet. So I mean, private settings, it includes things like condo and apartment hallways and other shared spaces. And then on July 29th, and we supported this, 8 Clark County superintendents announced on July 29th that they would recommend virtual learning to start the school year. And on August 5th, the governor, the Office of State, and the state announced updated school guidance and a decision tree for resuming in-person instruction. And the categories are based on COVID-19 activity, and we're in the high-risk category. So the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction basically recommended, and the governor and DOH recommended that if you're in the high-risk category, you really need to be starting with not in person, but in a remote setting. I sent off a letter to Green Mountain and asked about this, Green Mountain School District. And I sent a letter off to them, and the superintendent appreciated it, that we're recommending, even in rural areas like that, that they begin with remote instruction. And here, I basically got ahead of myself here. Greater than 75 per 100,000 is a high activity level. Beginning with distance learning, there's an option for limited in-person learning for high-need children. Sports and extracurricular activities remain on pause. And then you can see it gradually changes. I'm not going to go into in the interest of time, talk about 25 to 75 or below 25, because we're not there yet at this point. If you really want to be mesmerized, you can take a look at the entire decision tree. Based on your level of activity on the left, it says what you can do. And then basically, if you can have any in-person instruction in the middle there, you have to implement these safety measures. And then when you've implemented all of them, you have to be ready to monitor and respond to suspected and confirmed cases. So that's what schools will be looking at over time. Okay, so any questions about the COVID-19 update or any of the guidances? I went through this pretty quick. I think you're on mute, whoever's speaking.
I have a quick question, Dr. Mel. Do the daycare centers have to abide by the same criteria as schools?
They're not schools, but and I don't have the daycare in front of me, but they're not. They're yeah. This is basically through K through 12 what we're talking about here.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Any other questions? Okay, I'm just going to go briefly into, this is a warm-up for Aru's interesting presentation. I just wanted to talk, I presented some of this information to the Board of Health, and I just wanted to share it with you as well. So we all know that, you know, adverse social, economic, and environmental conditions create health inequities, health disparities. And you know, an example of how racism does this. Racism is a social determinant of health, but people who are black suffer from have a higher likelihood of lower wages, including lower wages for similar work than white people do. Often not preferred or selected for jobs. There's really good evidence on this. There's issues around more likely family separation, children growing up without one or more parents, without fathers, because of increased incarceration rates for black men. The long history of denial of small business and mortgage loans, and restrictions on purchasing homes, and we're not even getting into the whole issue about redlining that has been going on for years, where black people were not able to purchase homes, and certainly being able to purchase homes in certain areas. Education systems are linked to property taxes. We know that education is a social determinant of health, and education systems are linked to property taxes. And children of color are more likely to live in areas where the property taxes are lower and their schools are poorer schools, this results in lower graduation rates and less likelihood to be able to attain a higher education. And we all know that people of color also have less access to health care. And we've seen that play out. I'm just going to mention, I think I have a couple of examples here in Clark County. So we know that people of color, communities of color in Clark County have lower life expectancies, lower levels of education, high levels of uninsured than their white counterparts. The Healthy Youth Survey that we present reveals that children of color are more likely to be bullied at higher rates than those of white students. And the COVID-19, COVID-19, even though it's a infection, it's a biologic phenomenon, just like other health conditions, we're seeing disparities. It's disproportionately impacting communities of color in Clark County. And, you know, the Firestone outbreak, you know, highlighted that. So even though the Latinx community in Clark County is 10% by population, more than a third of the cases, of the confirmed cases where we had ethnicity data available, are in the Latinx population. And the Firestone outbreak involved, I believe, if I remember correctly, we had, you know, well over 100 cases. I'm thinking we had 132 off the top of my head. It was a significant proportion of the cases that we had in the county. And they were, you know, in the Firestone outbreak, they were essential workers. So just like healthcare workers, you know, folks working in the food industry are heroes and essential, doing essential work for all of us. But their working conditions and their contributed to disease transmission. I believe they had a telehealth policy, but basically they were uninsured. And when you look at, you know, work situations like that, not only lack of insurance, but also limitations on sick time, you know, being able to call in sick, being concerned about your job, being concerned about, potential, if you do ask for help, issues around concerns about ICE and, immigration authorities, and then limited access to healthcare and even testing for these populations. So we see it play out in Clark County as well as nationally. And this, not only impacts all kinds of health conditions, but certainly COVID-19 is a perfect illustration of it. One of the points I made to some of the to the Board of Health members is that, and I met with them individually on this, is that I don't know how good the analogy is, but it's not just a matter of changing behavior. It's a matter of, we've looked at the socioecologic model. I think about this in a way in terms of addressing systemic racism as a way we address tobacco. When the Surgeon General's report came out in 1965, there was some controversy there. But what really helped get tobacco down was not just telling people to stop smoking, but it was changing policies, changing laws, changing organizational policies, and actually community engagement. It's really gonna require a public, in terms of the lens of public health, addressing this at all kinds of levels, including, changing our institutions that contribute to this. So I think that may be it for my part, and I don't know if anybody has any questions. Hearing none, I'll stop sharing.
Thank you, Dr. Melnick. That was really terrific. And now we'll be joined by Aru from Durkee, who will give us a presentation about this very topic, who's done some study on this and provided, we got articles from, I think, both Dr. Melnick and from Aru, and those were very eye-opening. So thank you, Aru, for joining us as a presenter today.
Thank you. I'm going to see if I can share my screen. Can everyone see this okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
All right. The first time I'm sharing my screen on a Zoom call. So, so just as a reminder to everyone, I'm Arun Durthi. I am representing the physicians in Clark County. I'm a psychiatrist myself. I work at Vancouver Clinic. So I have been very honored to have been part of some of these conversations with a lot of my patients, but thinking about how this has affected me on a personal level. So I really wanted to talk about racism and COVID-19 and kind of paint a picture, hopefully, of how these are two public health crises of the moment, but also how racism has really impacted COVID as well. So let me set the stage. Obviously, we've all heard about COVID-19 ad nauseum. As of today, there's 20 million cases in the world, 739,000 deaths. In the U.S., we have 5 million, so about a quarter of the cases in the world, so we certainly don't have a quarter of the world's population, and 161,000 deaths. And of course, these numbers change every day. In the backdrop of COVID, came the tragic death of George Floyd and the protests that followed. And I am somewhat embarrassed to say this, this is the first time I paid attention this is the first time I took notice of what was happening in our communities. And I really felt like it was incumbent upon myself to learn as much as I can and really use that as a stepping stone for how can I make change. So I was very fortunate to be able to participate in both an educational lectures, but also small group discussions through the Women's Center for Leadership in Portland all through July on systemic racism, you know, on trying to understand the history of racism in our country, going all the way back, in fact, to our Constitution, to microaggressions. You know, I'm really excited to share some of this with you. And I don't have a lot of slides because I really wanted to leave as much time as I can for discussion. As I read more about racism as a public health crisis and as I read more about COVID, I began to see that these two are so inextricably linked. And Dr. Melnick has set the stage for this. But the impact of COVID-19 on African Americans, and, you know, while I've presented most of this data on the African American community, I also recognize other communities of color, including Latinos and Native Americans, have similar challenges. But COVID-19 has had a disproportionate impact on African Americans in terms of hospitalizations, deaths, economic consequences such as jobs and finances, as well as mental health. And I'll touch on the mental health piece towards the end of my presentation as well. These are statistics that shocked me. When you look at a share of a state or a city's population and their share of COVID-19 deaths, and I appreciate Dr. Melnick bringing the Clark County data, but look at Louisiana, 32% African-American population, but 70% of the deaths. And Chicago has very similar numbers. And this is something that we see across the nation. This is not confined to any particular geographic region. This is just something we see nationally. And so, you know, it really begs the question of, why? Why is COVID disproportionately impacting our communities of color? And at least, you know, a big part of the answer, I think, is the impact of racism. It really affects every aspect of the Black experience and drives this vulnerability to COVID-19. A lot has been made, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, and these have actually included comments from our Surgeon General on the higher rates of comorbidities in African American populations. So hypertension, diabetes, heart disease. Of course, these comorbidities don't come from, you know, nowhere. These are very much rooted in our healthcare system and the inequities in the healthcare system. But I think at the start of this pandemic, a lot was made of how, oh, you know, like there's just these increased comorbidities and, there was certainly calls from, if, like I said, even from the Surgeon General on, you know, it's really up to African American communities to change their behavior and, you know, take better care of yourself and go see the doctor and, I think that's a very narrow way of looking at it, and really I think blames the victims. And so while certainly there is increased comorbidity, which, you know, places African American populations at risk, again, this really is rooted in racism and the socioeconomic determinants. Communities of color are likely to be unemployed or underemployed or working blue collar jobs where they don't have the luxury of working from home. If you work in retail or, you know, then you have to go in to work. You can't work from home. They're more likely to rely on public transit. Housing is, you know, can be substandard. So all of these, you know, which again are very much rooted, I think, in the systemic racism, which Alan touched on, all contribute to the increased exposure to COVID-19. There's actually also been studies looking at rates of testing, and we see that in communities of color, there's just fewer tests available and fewer treatment options because of less access to hospital systems or, you know, doctor's offices, higher rates of incarceration among African Americans. And something that I had not ever thought about, but wearing a mask in public can be dangerous if you are African American, because you can be targeted by individuals or even police. And so I think all of these really has driven the vulnerability to COVID-19 in our communities of color. Kind of just briefly touching on also COVID and mental health and how racism has impacted this. I have seen in my own practice the huge spike in anxiety and depression since COVID. There's some studies recently, you know, that have said there's about a threefold increase both in anxiety and depression. Usually anxiety and depression together, and you certainly see this data from, you know, January to June of last year to May of, compared to May of this year, huge increases in anxiety and depression. This is just another way of looking at that. People reporting high levels of distress when it comes to COVID-19. I don't think there's anyone who hasn't been affected by this in some way or the other. What is very tragic about this is that in our communities of color, particularly the African American population, there's already very limited access to mental health treatment, and COVID and the disparities that it has brought to light, I think, highlight this, that when you look at mental health treatment disparities, you compare white to black or African American, both in men and women, rate of treatment or mental health service use is much lower, and this is, you know, certainly something that I think as COVID has increased levels of stress and depression, certainly I think to a higher extent even in African American communities because of increased infection with COVID, more job, financial stress, less access to healthcare. I think this is going to be a huge challenge for us as a society on how do we tackle this? I think to Alan's point of it really does need to be systemic, you know, policy changes. So I have been thinking a lot about trauma in communities of color. And, you know, trauma, as you're all aware, is such a huge impact on mental health and every other facet, really, of our life. And, generally when we think about trauma, you know, we think about ACEs, we think about trauma at the individual level. But when you look at communities of color, there's different kinds of trauma, I think. There's, of course, the individual trauma, which is driven by negative life events. There's also more complex trauma, where this is now multi-generational, and this can be driven by poverty, abuse, being a witness to community violence or police violence. So this is now trauma that is kind of larger than you, right? It encompasses your whole community, your whole family. And then we think about collective trauma, the trauma of slavery, natural disasters like Katrina, which also disproportionately affected the African American population. And then a more kind of historical or cultural trauma where, you know, what is our public narrative and how does that really perpetuate trauma? You know, this can be microaggressions, very, you know, very subtle, indirect forms of racism. And really, this is the kind of trauma, I think, that can leave very long-lasting memories in the consciousness of a group. And when you encounter these kinds of traumas day in and day out, you know, it has a huge impact on not just your mental health, but your emotional health too. There's lots of studies looking at, you know, and we know this from, you know, things like ACEs, when you're constantly exposed to stress, and this can even be, you know, the stress of living in neighborhoods where there is more community violence or police violence, witnessing that, you know, it has huge impacts on mental health, but certainly also on your physical health as well. So I really, you know, I think just setting the stage for how I don't think, you know, we can look at something like COVID, which is a big public health crisis, you know, without really understanding how racism and systemic racism impacts these public health challenges that we face. And I think, you know, COVID really highlighted for me just how pervasive this is, and really that we can't hope to tackle, you know, these public health challenges, COVID, you know, if an infection, without really tackling racism. And so that's actually really all I have for slides, but I wanted to end with this little poem. So it's, I think it can be easy to feel demoralized, and I certainly have felt this way over the last several months, kind of looking at what's going on around us and, you know, thinking, gosh, like I wish, you know, 2020 would just, I wish we could just move on. And I found one of my friends sent this to me, and it says, what if 2020 isn't canceled? What if 2020 is the year we've been waiting for? A year so uncomfortable, so painful, so scary, so raw, that it finally forces us to grow. A year that screams so loud, finally awakening us from our ignorant slumber. A year we finally accept the need for change, declare change, work for change, become the change. A year we finally band together instead of pushing each other further apart. 2020 isn't canceled, or rather the most important year of them all. And I think I'm really hoping that, you know, as FAC, we can continue this conversation and think about how we can start to tackle some of these challenges in our community. So that's really all I have for slides. I, again, really wanted this to be more of a discussion and not me lecturing at everyone. So I will stop there, and I'm happy to take questions and open it up to discussion.
Aru, this is Joan. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you for your wonderful presentation. I think you've sort of set the stage, and I think like you, many of us have sort of felt this arrow in our heart about having to do something, because especially as a white person, the piece of art that I saw that got me thinking about what more could I do was posted early in the COVID, and it was along with the murder of George Floyd, and it was a piece of art, words on a white background that said, white people, do something. And I think that the more I've learned about the personal learning that I've taken on, just to understand the privilege that I have being a white person and what I can do just in my life to become an ally and an anti-racist, it's important. The one thing I'd like to recommend to everybody is, I don't know if everybody knows, but in Vancouver we have a program called Van Talks, much like TED Talks, and it's usually held every year at the Kiggins. This year it was held virtually online on Zoom, and there were several hundred people on. And it was the stories of four individuals in our community about their lived experience as a black person in Clark County. The Van Talks website has these available online to watch. And it makes it, if you watch them, it really brings the racism in our community up front and personal, because you actually hear from people who live in our community and share their experience of being in this community. And so I'll send that link to Doreen, and then she can send it out to folks. And if you have time, I encourage you. These are 15-minute talks, just like TED Talks. And it really brings it right home to our community, right here where we live. So thank you for bringing this up. And I think thank you for the articles that you've shared, and also the articles that Dr. Melnick shared. I think that's one thing that all of us can do, is become much better informed of what is actually happening and the data, and actually then make a personal commitment to doing something about it. So thank you so much. And thanks to Dr. Melnick, too, for your introduction and the articles that you shared, which were excellent as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Joan. Aru, this is Roxanne. I wanted to piggyback on that. The city is doing some listening sessions, which you may all have heard about. There was a first round that was a week and a half or so ago. The second listening session is tomorrow night, and it is online. The time is, and I will get that for you right now off of my calendar, so the time is tomorrow afternoon from 5:30 to 7:30. And this will also be similar to the Van Talks. This will be folks that will be able to share publicly their perspectives of how racism has affected them. And I think it's going to be a really great session. If you all have a chance to they will be recording these too afterwards, but if you have a chance to listen in, these have been really, really good discussions, and I'm looking forward to the discussion tomorrow night.
Any questions or other comments, thoughts that individuals on our FAC committee have been having about these issues?
Well, I'll touch on it in a little bit. When I just talk about schools, I don't have a presentation or anything, but this is one of the things that is at the forefront of all of the educators I know around equity. And especially as we talk about opening school, or in this case, not opening school and working remotely, and trying to make sure that we don't lose students. And it's students of color, it's students in poverty, it's students in special education. And right now that's the lens I'm looking through, which is, pretty daunting, when we're looking at not knowing how to meet the needs of these kids right now. Anyway.
And, kids of in communities of color, as you've mentioned, are disproportionately impacted. They don't have the same access to online learning. And oftentimes, both parents might be working jobs that don't let them work from home. It's such a huge challenge. I'm not sure what the answers are, really, or how the schools to work around this.
When I think about my own situation with our kids, we have two kids who are starting sixth grade, and we're concerned about them falling behind. But we're in a position where we can do things like provide tutoring, and childcare is not really an issue. And we realize how fortunate we are in that sense. And I think about a lot of our kids in poverty, which are often our kids in color, of color. And Yeah, and it's, we're trying to figure out how we can, and it's because it's not just internet access. I mean, everybody thinks often that that's the key, which I agree, it is the key. However, that comes with supports. My daughters need help with different things that they just can't quite figure out. And luckily they have my wife and me and our older kids to help them.
This is Paul. Wanted to just mention that with the protesters that are at Portland, many, many of them are white, which is kind of an interesting thing, but they're all protesting for George Floyd, and they're protesting for racism and along those lines. But to the opposite degree, the people that, there's the protesters and then there's the agitators. Agitators take over after the protesters have made their speeches and have gone home. And the agitators are also turned out to be mostly white. So, but there's also another degree in there also. There are some white supremacists that have been mixed in with the agitators, so that we will continue to have this bubbling pot of racism that is still being happening in these. So therefore, you got these different groups of people, and what generally the people that are from out of the Portland area see are, they think everything is all the same group, but there's several different groups that are mixed in with that. And in some cases, the agitators are making the protesters look bad, and these are the ones that were standing up for racism. So just thought I'd throw that in. But we had a interesting thing happen today, a very plus thing that happened today. Joe Biden, who is going to be running for president, has named a black woman as his running mate. Kamala Harris is now his running mate, which I think will be a very interesting ticket. So just thought I'd throw that in. Thank you.
Thank you. That was good. Appreciate you speaking up. Who else has a comment to make or a question?
Aru, this is Roxanne again. I just want to say thank you so much. Your the poem at the end, what you said was, I thought, outstanding, and it gives us hope. So that's wonderful. It's very easy to get sort of demoralized as we're sort of involved in all these things and all this upheaval. So thank you for sharing that. I thought that was really, really outstanding. So thanks.
I want to echo that, Aru. That exceeded my expectation. Well, my expectations were pretty high, but that's really well done. I think I just want to add that our EPI folks have been doing syndromic surveillance throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. And I may have shared this with you, but they were looking at, one of the syndromes they were looking at is disaster-related mental health conditions that are seen in the EDs. And there was really in March, and compared to previous years, is there in April there was this blip. I can get you the graphs there, but we did see an increase in visits. I think they were all healthcare visits. It came from the Essence database, but there was an increase in all types of healthcare visits related to things like anxiety. Conditions that are associated with disasters, so throw that in there. But your talk was really it was pretty inspirational. So I'm not sure where FAC really wants to go on this. I'm looking forward to more discussions, because I think FAC can play a real strong role in helping move this forward. And I'm not sure exactly how to, maybe we spend more time talking about, thinking about how we can move
this forward. I know the Board of Health, you know, has, you know, had some discussions about this, but, and you do advise the Board of Health, but thinking about ways that we can move this forward.
Thank you.
I really would love that too.
This Mark, I have a comment. I know from the past we've had some minority representation, but we really don't now. And maybe we could reach out again and try to recruit some people.
That is a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, Alan, I was going to ask you if you could comment on, you know, I think just to understand, you know, what is, where is the Board of Health, you know, with, you know, even recognizing that racism is a public health crisis, its impact on COVID, and I think, you know, I'm not sure either, like, you know, what our best role can be and how we can affect change, but do you feel like there is an appetite for change, I guess, that for this?
Well, I really have to hope. I think you've heard some of the comments by one or two of the Board of Health members publicly. They're having their, I'm glad that Roxanne brought up the listening session, because they're actually the audience. They're the main audience for the listening session. So I think I think it would be those who can participate in the first listening session was actually, I listened to it, was actually speakers with presentations. I think the next one, I think they're actually, there's actually going to be Black members of the community speaking about their own personal experience. I think that's the next listening session. And our Roxanne, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but you both said, but I think the council, you know, the board members could be listening to that, and I think I'd really recommend that folks listen in, and then we maybe in fact have some more discussions about how to approach this with our board. I think our Board of Health has some folks who are very open to the, you know, understand the concept of systemic racism, and then there's some members who are basically struggling with that concept. But I think I have to hope that, you know, that there's room to move this discussion, and I think FAC could potentially play a role in making that happen.
Ellen, I wanted to jump in. I think the listening sessions do include any public members, any communities, people with communities of color that would like to address this issue. I don't think it's open to just, you know, to just any one group. I think it's pretty much a public forum.
I may be confusing the different kinds of listening sessions more, because the first one I went to had some formal speakers with it.
I read it. I'm very interested in these, and I did a little reading on it. It sounds like it will be individuals who they are taking 30 individuals who will speak about their own personal experience. And I hope that that will have a powerful impact on the counselors, on our Board of Health, hearing directly from people who have experienced the kinds of things that we're talking about today and what it does to them as an individual and as a member of our community. So I couldn't tell from what I read if it's going to be virtual sessions.
Yes, it will be. Yes, it's virtual sessions, and so you can live stream it. You can just right. Google it or whatever. We can also send you out a link.
It's a Zoom link, is it, Roxanne? There's a Zoom link to it.
Yeah, we'll send out a link. Yep,
absolutely. Great.
And then, and then they're also going to record it. So the first session was recorded, second session will be recorded as well.
Good. Excellent.
Yeah, you know, and besides dealing with the, you know, the whole issue of the systemic racism, I think getting across the concept to folks about privilege and what it means to be, I mean, that's a discussion I think we need to have more of, you know, in our community as well, in terms of eventually moving people. And I'm not sure how to, you know, I was thinking about the, and I was thinking about it when Aru was talking about it, you know, we had the Firestone outbreak. We those of us with privilege who are able to keep our jobs and work remotely, we're all Zooming and doing these kinds of conferences. Communities of color had to work and didn't have the option of remote. You know, you can't do that work remotely, and you know, it's a clear example of the privilege that we have to be able to do what we're doing. You know, some of us doing what we're doing right now. Anyway, I think we need to have more conversations about that as well. I get that it's threatening to folks, but it's an uncomfortable conversation that people need to have.
Absolutely. Well, and the other piece, you know, when I think about the systemic racism and how it impacts the healthcare systems is African Americans are much less likely to trust, you know, their doctors, the public health system. You know, and this is rooted in history. This does not come out of nowhere. In looking at a study yesterday where a greater percentage of African Americans said that they're not sure that they would actually get a COVID-19 vaccine if it did exist. Because they're distrustful of our healthcare system, which has, I think, huge ramifications in terms of the public health piece for COVID.
And, you know, it's not any surprise. I mean, the Tuskegee study ended less than 50 years ago. I mean, that's, there's a long history there of not only denying care, but, you know, abusing, you know, the healthcare system abusing folks. So,
Yeah, and I see this in my mental health, you know, in my practice too. I think there's not a lot of people of color who, you know, seek mental health care in the first place. But what I've seen in my clinical experience, they also tend to drop out of care. And oftentimes it's because they have other extenuating circumstances that basically make it impossible for them to come to the doctor. I mean, it can be transportation, they can't get time off of work, they don't have the same access to telehealth that most of us do. And even though rates of mental health are similar across, African Americans and, whites, the rate of treatment and staying in treatment, seeking treatment in the first place is much lower. And I see this in my own practice, and it's very frustrating because there's not a lot I can do to, you know, help someone's economic situation or, you know, but it's certainly, well, just certainly something I've seen that impacts their care quite a bit. Oftentimes they don't have a primary care doctor. You know, if they come to see me, they haven't seen the doctor in years. And so I think, just affects everything.
One of the things that FACT might be able to do is to really drill down and take a look at including the data in Clark County and take a look at the effects of systemic racism. You know, we have different data sets that we can use that, and then you can actually provide, I don't know if there would be a paper, I'm not sure exactly, and I don't want to say what folks should do, but you can actually, you know, do some more drilling down in terms of this issue.
Mm-hmm. That would be great. Any other comments or questions before we shift gears? I would like to thank our physicians that presented today and really appreciate the work that went into it and the wonderful way that you presented the information. It's so important for all of us to hear this, and I really do hope that it does galvanize us around a very well-known public health crisis. And if not us, then who? So
Can I get a copy of the poem? That was...
Yes. I can send it to you.
Write the poem.
Would you send it out
So it's by Leslie Dwight. She's on, on Instagram, and she's I think the founder of a digital marketing company. So she has her own small business. I don't know much more about her or if she is quote famous in some other way. But this was a poem that one of my friends shared with me. When I talked about how demoralized I felt about, saying, I just wish we didn't have to deal with 2020. And this was just a really nice perspective, that change often comes about because of difficulty, not because things are going well.
That's so true. So true.
But yes, I'm happy to send the poem to everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, we are getting sort of down to 15 minutes left of our meeting time as I'm reading the agenda. So we still wish to hear from Dave, who will provide an update on CRESA. And then after Dave is finished, then Sharp is going to give us some additional information perhaps about the school openings. That would be really wonderful. I know it's on everybody's mind right now who has kids or kids in the neighborhood, or it's a very important part of our lives, whether we have children in school or not. So, Dave, did you want to go first and bring us a CRESA update?
Sure, I can do that. I'm not sure I want to follow Haru, though. She did such a good job.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
All right, well, hopefully you can see that.
It's very good.
Just kind of a quick history on CRESA. And CRESA is we actually oversee three different programs there. The 911 call taking and dispatching, the emergency management for the county, and then also the public safety radio system that all of the first responders use. We're a nationally accredited, recognized agency. What you may not know is that we're actually not a department of the county or a department of the city. We're actually an independent agency that was formed through an interlocal agreement between the seven cities and the county. We have about 85 employees with the four divisions there, the operations, the emergency management, the technical services, which is and radios. And then the admin, which really equates to the finance side, and then the numerous public records requests that we get every day. On the emergency management side, we've been really pretty busy with COVID-19. While I like the poem, there's a part of me that's really anxious for 2020 to get done and for us to kind of work through this process, because it's actually been a little bit long, as I think Dr. Velmick would attest to. The first case that really presented itself was in March 2nd. We did a modified activation of the EOC, and then we've actually been in full activation since March 16th. And primarily our role at this point is being moving over towards really supporting logistics for the county. And then the Joint Information Center, which again was activated on March 16th. On the 19th, we really moved in more into a support role. Clark County Public Health is really the lead agency as it relates to the COVID response for the county. And we're really aligned to be able to help them in their mission. And again, really the regional EOC setting up the supply warehouse for personal protective equipment. Some of the things the bigger projects we've worked on is, the City of Vancouver, working with them and establishing the Safe Park location, which was an area that was identified for those folks that are without homes, living in their cars in a an area, identifying an area that was safe for them to go and park and leave their vehicle there, provide some services and sanitation in a local area. Also establishing, working with Clark County to put in as much as we can, one focal point, one website that people can go in and get their COVID-19 information and everything from kind of the links that go back to public health, as well as some of the recovery efforts and some of the funding that might be available or grants for folks that are in the community. Clark County also established a community service, or worked with community services in establishing isolation and quarantine, and then working through FEMA to get some of that recognized ultimately. So hopefully we can get some funding associated back with that. Again, the CARES funding's been very helpful in trying to help the county move that forward. All the other things is, as we saw the unemployment rates go up, we also saw a big need for the food banks and services there. And actually, we've been using the food banks as ways to also get out some of the supplies as it relates to masks and things that are available for the community to be able to help assist in distributing that. A couple of other things is created some surge capacity for the medical examiner's office, coordinated a bulk order of personal protective equipment early on. The state wasn't able to get their hands on as much of the PPE as we needed in the community, and so we coordinated a private purchase with the vendor and was able to bring in some additional KN95 masks and surgical masks and gloves that we needed through another vendor until we could really get the state to help us and step up and move forward there. The PPE warehouse is really the biggest thing that we continue to support and move on right now. So far, the personal protective supplies are really aimed at our medical providers and the first responders. We've supplied 428 agencies within the county. That includes the hospitals, the fire and EMS agencies, police, long-term care facilities, dental, foster care homes. So far to date, I think we've had 530 different requests and amounted to over 600,000 PPE items that have been distributed throughout the county. Continue to work and support public health. They have huge initiatives that they're working on, really working on getting the testing done. And as we've heard from Dr. Milling, there's just a lot of work. One of the things that we have been able to do is establish, as we've been getting in supplies, we've actually created a reserve. So we have a reserve of PPE, enough for a two-week supply for the hospitals and the first responders in the agency. So if something starts to dry up, we can actually move into that cache and have that at our ready access. In addition to that, we've been able to build a pretty good supply of the testing swabs and transport medium for being able to do the COVID tests. We are starting to see some shortages in some of the areas. Those include gloves. For a while we could get all the gloves we wanted, but now there seems to be a shortage on gloves, and particularly for the smaller ones. Gowns continue to be an issue. It turns out that gowns are made from the same material that the N95 masks are made. So manufacturers are either making masks or they're making gowns. And there's been a much greater need for masks. So gowns have been in short supply. And then the one that we've run into most recently, particularly at the hospitals and some of the clinics, is their testing reagent. So rather than the patient side, the swabs and the transport medium, where we saw the shortages early on, now we're seeing it more on the back end as it relates to the medium that they, or the reagent they actually need to run the tests against. And so that is a shortage that we're seeing not only here in the community, but statewide and actually across the country. We continue to coordinate the efforts with state emergency management division, and then we actually host and participate in calls with the seven cities and the county every once a week on Thursdays to kind of make sure that we have a coordinated message and taking advantage of that JIC and making sure that the public information, along with the information that we get from Dr. Melnick and public health, is being shared across the community as a whole. Actually, let me pause on that for a second. Some of the other issues that we're really dealing with on the JIC, some of the challenges that we continue to run into on a day-to-day basis is really the misinformation and trying to make sure that clear messages are getting out that are actually accurate. There's a phenomenal number of conspiracy theories out there that they spend a lot of time trying to work through and debunk. There's often a lot of questions as it relates to, is this real? Are these numbers real? And are we double counting folks? And the reality is that the numbers are real. They're not double counted. That funding is not tied to the number of cases that we report. You heard from Dr. Melnick earlier, and Jeff, as far as what the funding looked like from the feds and from the state, and it's really not tied to patient volume at all, but there does seem to be misinformation out there associated with that. The other is really the mask effectiveness, and why should I wear a mask? I think that the city of Richfield's actually done a really good job as it relates to their program that they're rolling out called Masking for a Friend, or Who Are You Masking For? And really the focus on you're wearing the mask to help protect those around you. And if, of course, we're all doing it, then we're helping to protect each other. But really the mask is not, it doesn't take the place of distance and making sure that you continue to do the social distancing. And so those are some of the things that we just keep trying to pound on a daily and weekly basis. Like we heard before, it takes a long time to change a culture, and it's going to take a long time to help folks really understand that this is probably the new norm, at least for some period of time. On the 911 operations, those continue as normal, and what I mean is they're another group of folks who do not get to work virtually. They have to be in the 911 center 365 days, 24 hours a day. There's not really a mechanism that allows us to telecommute and do the work. Because of that, I'm very protective of that workforce. We only have 42 dispatchers that serve the whole county. It's very important that we keep them healthy and that we keep COVID out of our facility. And to that end, we've had to make some modifications to the workspace, really limit the number of people who have access to the building. Before, it was pretty common to have, police and fire and other folks stop by to say hi, and we've really had to clamp that down and do some pretty significant, surveys and testing and temperature readings and masking, as well as just some engineering of the building to help make sure that we're protecting them. Summer is always a busy time for us, so to have this kind of on top of like the 4th of July has created some an interesting year for us. This 4th of July actually seemed like it was even more busier than ones in the past. We were kind of at a point where everybody was just tired of being inside and kind of took advantage of the good weather and were out there. And so during that 24-hour period, we ran or answered 3,166 calls, which is about 2 days worth of calls in a one-day period. And 1,200 of those calls came in a 90-minute period when fireworks first started going off between 9:30 and 11, which again is close to kind of a slow day's worth of total volume there. Overall, during the time, the volume has been pretty steady. However, we have seen a shift in acuity, and it kind of goes back to what Aruru was saying. We have definitely seen an increase in domestic violence calls as folks have been under more stress related to COVID. We've also seen an increase in our mental health calls and self-harm, suicide rates, or attempted suicide. And so just kind of the acuity and some of the things that have been encountered over the course of the last 6 months have been a lot more intense for the dispatchers. One of the counterintuitive things that we found is that while the calls for the ambulance service have been kind of steady, there has been a significant increase in the number of patients that are refusing to go to the hospital. So they would come and be evaluated by fire and EMS, but then refuse to be transported. And that's actually one of the metrics that they track on a pretty regular basis. And went from kind of a no transport rate of about 20%, you know, would be normal, to a no transport rate of about 60%, which is significantly higher. The other part that we saw is people not really wanting to call 911 for their medical emergency, and so we actually ended up having to go do some education that said, no, if you are having chest pain or having these other medical issues, to make sure that you seek care. So again, that one's been a little bit interesting and kind of counterintuitive. You would think that in the pandemic that we would have seen a really significant increase in the ambulance volume, but it's sort of remained the same, and we've actually seen a decrease in those being transported to the hospital. And that's pretty much CRESA in a nutshell. And don't want to run too far over. Any questions?
This is Paul. Would you think that the decrease in wanting to go to the hospital would have anything to do with their fear of being, their fear of COVID possibly being at the hospital?
I think that was part of the driver, was, you know, feeling that COVID was definitely present in the hospital. The reality is the hospital is probably one of the places that's most focused on, you know, being clean and taking the appropriate steps. I think the other part that may have been driving it, though, was for a long time we had policies in place that if you went to a hospital, you were going there by yourself. And so you didn't have to have, you didn't have the luxury of having families and friends around you or being able to go to the hospital with you. And so if they felt like if it was even remotely something that they could deal with on their own, they were going to go ahead and stay home. So,
yeah, if I can add, we were monitoring emergency department visits. We've been monitoring it throughout the pandemic, and they were way down in the early stages, and they're just beginning, and they've been increasing ever since. But visits to clinicians' offices were down also. I think at one point we got some messaging out with our healthcare partners that, you know, it's safe to go to the, you know, to go to the healthcare, and it's safe to go to the ED. But there were concerns that people were even for severe concerns like, you know, chest pain and all that, people were avoiding the EDs, and it was a lot of it was concern about we know it was concern about COVID-19.
I also wanted to add that just, Dave, that CRESA has just been an incredible partner for public health, and we want to call that out and say how much we appreciate that partnership and all you've done for us. I mean, we couldn't have done this without you, so thank you very much.
Yeah, well, I want to second that. It's a team effort, so thanks, Dave. No,
thank you.
Indeed, thank you, Dave. Well, let's hear from Charbonneau about the schools.
Yeah, you know, it's been pretty interesting because even as Dave was talking, I'm thinking about just all of the different things. So I didn't put together any sort of presentation, but I'm happy to answer any questions. But the biggest thing, you know, for us, and I'm going to just speak on behalf of myself. I'm not speaking on behalf of Battleground Public Schools or any place I used to work. You know, our primary job is to keep our kids safe. And that's, you know, it's sort of all combined. We want to keep them safe. We want them to learn. We want them to have agency over their lives and do whatever path they choose that they can go that route. But, you know, so you're sort of in this catch-22 because we know that kids who are in homes in poverty or with abusive parents or who don't have childcare are suffering. And we know that the rates of depression and anxiety are skyrocketing. And so then you think, okay, the counter to that is we can get them back in, but if we get them back in too soon, then we have more cases, then we shut down again. And, you know, depending on your community, so when Chris Reichel, the State Department Superintendent of Public Education, came out with his, and he gives provides updates all the time, but one of the ones that stuck out to me was that one of the recommendations is to get input and cooperation from the community. Well, the community I serve in Battleground is largely a community that, if I make the mistake of getting social media, you know, don't believe in masks, don't believe that the virus is real, and I don't want to cast that wide net over my community. It's a great community, but like the town I'm from a small logging town called Castle Rock. Well, that everyone in Castle Rock thinks this is all a bunch of hooey. But that's the reality, you know, and so I have to, we're in a position where we need to protect our staff. And even if kids, kids can get it, as we know, but I've heard some opinions saying kids are immune to it and that type of thing, but if they're asymptomatic and they go home and they get mom sick and mom gets grandpa sick, you know, you go through all those different scenarios and then try to figure out the best way to do it. And we all want kids back. But even if we came back, it would be in a modified hybrid sort of model where instruction would be fundamentally different than it was anyway, where it would be 1 or 2 days a week for an hour, you know, for a shorter period of time, 6 feet apart. Poor ventilation in a lot of our public schools, and having to wear masks. So if I just think about myself in a Zoom meeting, or if I'm wearing a mask, as we were meeting today in person a little bit, we were very far spread apart, and outside. But, you know, you miss a lot of that human, the magic of teaching is often in our, you know, how dynamic we can be and how we can get kids engaged, even if they are finding Wuthering Heights to be extremely dull, we can hook them. And that wouldn't be the same either. So no matter what, this year, we're not very likely going to go back to what we all want. And for a lot of us, it's really challenging to, you know, we miss our kids, we miss our people. You know, we got into this work because we want to help people in, you know, in very broad terms. We love to help people and we love our people and we don't get to see them and it's really challenging. The Evergreen School District's board meeting is tonight to approve their plan. I believe Camas did. We live in Camas. We got emails from their district. Battleground board last night approved full remote learning, and that's what most of the schools we imagine are going to go to. In fact, I heard of one in Kitsap that their board voted to reopen, and then the blowback from the community was such that they sort of quickly changed their mind. I could ramble on for a long time, but I don't want to do that. But if there are questions or anything, I'd be happy to have a conversation about it. That's what I did all day today. In fact, while we were sitting here, I got about 45 text messages from our administrative team at my high school. Just because it got approved last night, and today is all done. Okay, now what? And so, just there are many things to figure out.
How do the children... I mean, I know that I've seen that, like, Comcast is doing some stuff about internet, but what about homes that don't have that? And, you know, for the remote learning, what is a school doing, and what are the families expected to do? Where does that line come, especially mm-hmm. with the amount of poverty that's in your community up there in Battleground?
Well, and our poverty is very underreported. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at OSPI. At my high school in particular, Battleground High School, it looks like socioeconomically we are in really good shape. And we also know that it's a blue collar community.
That's right.
It's a middle class blue collar community. It's not a blue collar community that's suffering, but we obviously have a large chunk of kids who are in poverty and who are homeless. And how do we meet those needs? And so our district's been very committed to, we're able to purchase a certain number of hotspots. So when we tried to poll, and then you try to figure out how we communicate, for the most part now is electronically. Even before going into the pandemic. And so we would send out mailers. But so you're trying to gauge the community's ability to engage online, and knowing that outside Yakult and Amboy, our IT director is pretty sure that about 95% of the district families have access to the internet. But when you hear the anecdotal stories from parents, they don't. And if they do, it's really spotty. One of our teachers has dial-up, for crying out loud. Like, literally has an AOL email address at home. And, and we're expecting the teachers to be able to adapt to this, too. And that's just the reality, is we have to. But most districts I know are really working hard to make sure that all of their kids have devices and access to internet. Most schools have gone one-to-one, we call it, where each student gets a device of their own, usually a Chromebook, which are not the best, but they're not bad, so it's better than nothing. And for students who really don't have access to the internet, we tried to put together packets from different teachers, but that was pretty, and a lot of people in the community looked at the spring effort as being a failure. In fact, a lot of our teachers, because kids, as soon as it became evident from the state level that kids would not fail and that all of the things they could do could raise their grade, we had a lot of those students who were in the CD range who, that's what I'm going to get, and I can be done. And then they just stopped, and that was... So we shot ourselves in the foot a little bit sometimes, but, I think in the end, when we come out of this in 21, 22, 22, 23, where we are back to normal, I think our teachers will all be better for it, ultimately, because we're in the crucible right now.
What about the other part about the remote learning is, what about the capacity of the people in the home to help the students? I mean, especially, to be able to tutor their kids. Sometimes the parents just don't have the capacity. It's a blue-collar community. They may have their GED. They may not even have a high school degree. What kind of support is there for the parents to be able to support their kids?
Well, I can't speak for other districts. I know that one thing we're going to do is, and it all has to be virtual, obviously, is some parent learning. Not just about the platforms that we're using. We're using primarily Zoom and Google Classroom, but also about some basic tutoring things. And we're also trying to, as a district, And I know I have a lot of friends in the Evergreen School District and in Hawkinson, and all the districts locally at least are doing similar work. We're trying to put together, do we have recent graduates, or do we have kids who are seniors in high school or can we tap into our AP kids or our leadership kids to help provide some tutoring? Because it's, as I mentioned before, I talk about my privilege. I'm in a position where I can work remotely if I need to, and my kids can get tutoring if they need it. And we're lucky to have our older kids home with us, but both of us still have to work, And to be honest, in the spring, I didn't help my daughters a lot with their homework. Really, they would have some stuff that they would get done, and we would kind of go over it, but really, I tell you what, when they get into high school, I will not be able to help them with the math. But luckily, we have older brother and sister still here, so they can help with the math. But I can write anything they want, but... Yeah, but that's definitely, when I want to look at this year as a lens of equity. And on one hand, it's racial equity. On the other hand, it's also poverty, just poverty in general. And also our students with special needs we need to make it our mission to not lose kids.
Thank you.
Well, I just want to thank all of the speakers that we heard from tonight. It was really a great meeting, and I know we've gone over a little bit, but the the topics that were discussed, the investment that people made that brought information and inspiration to us. I think it was just so worth it. We have a great attendance at this, and I'm pretty impressed with in-person to a virtual format for our meetings. I don't feel like we've really lost a lot, if anything, in the translation. In fact, I feel like we had a great amount of participation. Mm-hmm. I really want to thank our speakers and also everybody else who spoke up. We've had really good investment in the discussions. So I'll just pass on that the next FAC meeting is October 13th, and the format is to be determined. I'm kind of hoping that we can continue to carry on like this so that we don't have people not attend because they might feel like it's too much risk. And I feel like we have such good interaction that it's working well for now. But we'll see what our experts say and definitely pay attention to that. Are there any comments of our members that they would like to share before we close the meeting?
Marla, this is Joan, and I always, as you know, I always have to say something. One of the things that that's a crisis in our community and across the country right now is who's going to take care of the children when the parents go back to work. And there are several groups that are working on some solutions in our community, and childcare have closed. You know, it's been a marginal business to run to begin with, but it's become a major public health interest across the country in terms of who's going to take care of the kids when there's no child care. And so, and I know I had talked about this at a previous meeting of what having, you know, Debbie Hamm, ESD, some folks come and talk about the child care crisis and what's happening in our community, because it is very real. And I think it's another area that is going to impact the lives of our families and children and in our whole economic vitality as a community. So just more to come on that.
Good. Looking forward to it. Thank you. Any other comments before we close? Then I'll just thank again everybody. I especially appreciate our public health team of experts, and I appreciate Doreen for doing such a great job materials out ahead of time and being so easy to get hold of, and she works very hard and does a great job for us. So great team, great FAC committee. Thank you. It's a privilege to be part of this. Hope you all have a good rest of the week.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Marla.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. I know.